Available for tonight's game against the Los Angeles Kings after taking a hit in the head from Anaheim's James Wisniewski last night. Seabrook left the game and did not return. The Blackhawks have lost three in a row now. And the St. Louis Blues visit Madison Square Garden tonight to play the New York Rangers. The Blues need a late surge to make the playoffs. They trail eighth-place Detroit by 7 points with 13 games left. That's sports.
Hi, this is Masumi Rostad of the Pacifica String Quartet. Please join WILL 40 North, Krannert, and me for the new Docha Chamber Music Festival. We are playing at Radio Maria, Cakes on Walnut, and Jim Gould's in downtown Champaign, April 1st to 3rd. Docha will feature great music from some of our town's finest musicians, including Stefan Milenkovich, Dmitry Kuzov, Rudolf Hawken, and my group, the Pacifica Quartet. Admission is free. For more information, visit docha.org.
Illinois began overhauling its youth prisons 4 years ago when it broke them off from adult corrections. And now Governor Pat Quinn is proposing to take it a step further by merging juvenile justice with the child welfare system. The idea is to finally shed the old model of warehousing and punishing kids and instead treat and rehabilitate them. But changing bureaucracy is one thing. It's another to change the mentality of the people who enforce rules, preside over meals, and break up fights. There's a new push to transform how frontline workers understand the minds and mental health of children. Illinois Public Radio's Gabriel Spitzer brings us that story in this installment of the series Inside and Out.
Illinois' juvenile prisons still share a lot with adult corrections, including space at the Springfield Training Campus. But the state is trying to untangle the cultures of these two departments. On a chilly day in February, the adult corrections cadets are marching in military formation. But up above the yard, on the second floor of a steel and glass building, the atmosphere is less boot camp and more college seminar.
How many of you guys have worked with kids already some places?
Wow, that's great.
These are the juvenile justice interns, fresh hires who will be working directly with the kids. The way they interact with them will help set the tone for the whole institution. And this training is a key step in transforming how Illinois handles incarcerated kids.
The morning is going to be child development and brain development and mental illness. And trauma.
Northwestern University psychologist Gene Griffin is running today's crash course on kids' brains. He believes if the prison staff understands why kids act the way they do, everyone will be better off. It's especially important because so many kids inside have mental health issues. As many as 70%, according to surveys.
Kids fall through the cracks and they end up in what system? Yeah, you guys get them, right? So some of these kids, we believe, if we would work with them sooner in the community, wouldn't need to come to juvenile justice. But all those networks aren't out there right now.
Rebuilding those networks is one reason the state might plow this whole department into the child welfare system. Gene Griffin worked with that system about 5 years ago, and it's now considered a leader in handling kids with trauma or behavior problems. In juvenile justice, the mental health training is new. This is just the second class of new hires to get it. To make it concrete, Griffin plays videos that reenact typical situations, like this one where a kid learns a family visit that day isn't going to happen.
You not coming?
Smith! Smith! Calm down!
The kid freaks out, kicking a desk and throwing chairs, but he doesn't threaten any people. So the question is, how would you guys handle that?
How would you guys handle that?
He should get disciplined for what he did, but that would be after he understood what he was doing, what he did wrong.
I would try to talk to him first. Talking to him does help.
I guess as long as he was kicking the trash cans or tipping the chairs over something, I wouldn't have said nothing, but when he punched the door, to me, that's a security issue right there.
For a long time, the way to handle that kind of situation would have been to throw the kid in solitary confinement. This training is supposed to give new frontline workers more options.
It's not easy. It is not quick. You got to have a lot of patience. But the point is these kids can change, just like I can change, just like you can change over time. Some kids do some awful things, but there's still hope for all of them.
The training curriculum is being developed by the MacArthur Foundation with help from Griffin and two Chicago-area colleagues. It's in pilot phase, and the idea is eventually to roll it out nationwide. Jennifer Jaworski heads up Behavioral Health Services for the Department of Juvenile Justice.
I think we are going to be state-of-the-art. I think we're on the cutting edge. They're building a treatment approach to youth that is very solid. It may take a bit longer to implement, but that's understandable. If it's worth building, it's going to take time to do that.
This curriculum is just one piece of that program, and even the biggest boosters warn the training has limitations. Kathy Scowra is associate director of the MacArthur Network overseeing the training project.
Clearly, we can't change the world with an 8-hour training and expect the way they interact with kids is going to be completely transformed and the systems will change overnight. We're not expecting that at all. We see this as one of many tools that will need to be employed in order to change the thinking and change the kind of response to these children.
And no matter how effective this tool is, so far, it's only going to a tiny minority of the staff. The trainers want to train all the workers, but that's costly, and it's not clear when that would happen. So the 85% of staff that predate the split of juvenile and adult prisons haven't gotten this training. Steve Eisenberg heads mental health at the youth prison in Joliet. He says those older workers may not exactly welcome the new ideas.
Well, it's tough because, if I may say so, I think you guys are intimidating to them because you're better prepared. So there's going to be a bit of a contest going on for a while until they take you in as an okay person.
Department officials concede that there could be a culture clash. Imagine for a second being part of the old guard. You have a dangerous job. You've learned the hard way how to stay safe and keep the place under control. Then along come these green cadets who've been trained to think what you do is wrong and heavy-handed. It's easy to see why you might resent the touchy-feely stuff.
The way it's going to come out is they're going to scoff at what you bring to the table. They may be a little burnt out. They're going to tell you that the one or two tools that they have are the real ones and everything else is nonsense. You worked hard to gain them. Don't let anybody burn you up by telling you that that's crap.
This collision comes out of a basic tension that runs through juvenile justice. How much energy can you devote to helping these kids, and how much do you need to lay down the law?
You want to do another case example? Tell me what you would do. Joe had been out for recreation. This is a kid in detention.
This case is about bending the rules. Do you make an exception for a kid to call his grandma, even though his free time is technically about to end? Robbie Reeves says no way.
Yeah, I wouldn't have even let him have it because I would have just think he's trying to manipulate me either way. I would have
Montrese Wade says cut the kid a break.
Well, I wouldn't personally feel like I have to show this kid that I know that he's...
They're both part of the new generation here at DJJ, but they bring very different perspectives. Reeves' last job was in an adult prison. Wade's background is with Child Protective Services. Their debate spills over into the next break.
That's okay with an inmate, but not saying. A child wanting to call mama. That's
but it makes it, you don't know he's different. Calling his mom.
You are standing there, you do know.
It's a constant hustle. You don't know he's doing that.
Reeves has worked in the juvenile prisons before. He was at Downstate Harrisburg before the department split. Now, retrained, he's heading back there with a unique perspective. He says he believes deeply in rehabilitation, but he's also skeptical. He's seen a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I am pessimistic, I guess, for working in corrections for a little while. And, I mean, I want to really see how this is going to be played out in real-life setting and everything. And I'm just interested to get in and see how it's going to work.
I shall. Act to preserve the safety.
The next day, the interns rehearse their graduation ceremony and practice their oath. From here, they will fan out among the 8 prisons Illinois has built for its children. And no matter which bureaucracy is in charge, it's these workers who will carry out the experiment in changing the culture of juvenile justice. I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
And we'll have the final report in that series tomorrow afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. For more than a decade, this statistic has been cited as evidence that rich and poor are treated differently by the justice system. Sentences for possessing crack cocaine are 100 times heavier than sentences for powder cocaine. Now the U.S. Senate has passed a bill to change that. NPR's Ari Shapiro has the story.
The debate about drug sentencing is full of ratios. Here's what the numbers mean in real-world terms.
The penalty for possession of a saccharin package worth of crack cocaine is a 5-year mandatory minimum.
Cynthia Orr is president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
And it goes up from there astronomically to where you're at a life sentence before you can bat an eye with crack cocaine, whereas you have to have 5 kilos of powder cocaine. So it's literally 100 times more severe penalty for the same amount of drug.
Congress enacted these rules in the early 90s when crack was ravaging urban communities. In those days, Reggie Walton worked on drug policy in the first Bush administration. Back then, he supported the sentencing disparity. Today, he's a federal judge in Washington, and he feels differently.
We believed it was a different chemical substance. We now know that that's not the case. The reality is that crack cocaine and powder cocaine are the same chemical substance.
Walton has testified before Congress on behalf of the Judicial Conference on this issue. He says the sentencing disparity has had a huge impact on people of color.
You have a large percentage of people who are either Latino or African-American who are being locked up for a significant period of time for a crack cocaine conviction.
That's partly because crack is much cheaper than powder. Judge Walton believes there will still be objections to the Senate bill from people who think crack and powder should be treated the same. This bill punishes crack users 18 times more heavily than powder cocaine users. Scott Burns, executive director of the National District Attorneys Association, thinks that's the right balance.
The political reality is there was going to be a reduction. And as opposed to 1-to-1, the district attorneys fully support the 18-to-1 disparity.
Now that the Senate has passed this bill, the House has to decide what to do. A House committee has already approved a bill that treats crack and powder identically. The full House could adopt the Senate's 18-to-1 sentencing ratio, or the House could push for its own bill with the 1-to-1 ratio. Cynthia Orr of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers says, of course she would prefer if crack were not treated 18 times more seriously than powder.
So yes, there's a great frustration, but it's 80% less great of frustration as it has been in the past. It's such an important move, and I'm not going to diminish it in any way.
Orr says if the Senate bill becomes law, she will consider that a great day. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Something strange happened this week in the world of television ratings. NBC didn't have a single show ranked in the top 20. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports that NBC is still recovering from the showdown between Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien and the end of the Olympics.
Here's what everyone's watching instead of NBC.
This is American Idol.
On Fox, CBS has a dozen top-ranked shows, including multiple CSIs. Name your location. And ABC has Grey's Anatomy and Desperate Housewives. NBC has Squat.
They are deep in a hole.
Eric Deggans covers television for the St. Petersburg Times.
The NBC brand used to stand for something. It was sort of urbane, cutting edge, drama, and comedy. That brand, you know, ran its course, and they didn't come up with a new one.
Fans of NBC's Thursday night lineup, 30 Rock, The Office, Parks and Rec, congratulations. Critics say you have excellent taste. But those shows just do not draw the massive audiences of comedies like CBS's 2 and a Half Men. Bill Gorman co-runs a website called TV by the Numbers. He blames NBC's colossal miscalculation concerning late-night talk shows.
NBC has been so radioactive this year and so noteworthy in its 10 p.m. disaster that all the light has been focused on them.
Gorman says shows depend on advertisers, and they don't care about rankings, just how many 18 to 49-year-olds are tuning in. And Gorman says NBC's travails have drawn attention away from another network disaster.
On a season-to-date basis, ABC is down 7% with adults 18 to 49. That's the worst performance of the broadcast networks.
Still, at least ABC's ratings should rebound with next week's return of Dancing with the Stars. As for NBC, Gorman predicts things will get worse before they get better.
NBC has not reached the bottom of where they're going to be this spring. They've got nothing left.
Most of us are looking forward to summer. NBC executives cannot wait till fall, when the network will launch a raft of new programming. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
How one listens to music matters a great deal to some, not only the musicians, but those obsessive enough to demand a certain musical order. Commentator Amy Guida puts herself in the second group in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
My husband and I agree on a lot of things, but certainly not on the shuffle option. For those of you who are not familiar with it, let's say that one has an old, Elton John album on one's iPod. One can either listen to the album the way the artist and or his producers intended, beginning with the melancholy funeral for a friend and ending with a much lighter harmony, or one can choose shuffle and hear, in random order, whatever songs the iPod, a machine without much capacity other than capacity, decides one should hear. Even saying the word shuffle in the context of an album or a CD creates in me a sensation similar to the one one gets from nails on a chalkboard. I think shuffling ruins artistic expression, believing every song has its place in the overall scheme of things. My husband disagrees. Now, it turns out that I'm right, broadly speaking, in a legal sense. Just a few days ago, the Associated Press reported that Britain's High Court had ruled in favor of the band Pink Floyd and against the record company that wanted to sell individual tracks of Pink Floyd songs, and not necessarily entire Pink Floyd albums. Granted, it was a contractual dispute, but the AP called the decision a victory for the concept album and ultimately for, quote, artistic integrity. I like that holding and that phrase very much, of course. If artistic integrity trumps the right to sell off an album piecemeal, it, in my book, trumps shuffling. Artistic integrity is part of the law in the United States, too, depending upon what sort of art we're talking about. Put another way, here at least, it's probably a good thing that Pink Floyd had an artistic integrity provision in its contract. A dissenting federal judge in Boston a few years ago wrote that not only was the term artistic integrity difficult to define, he could not find any case recognizing the right to it, even while admitting that the words themselves evoke a positive response and sound as if they ought to come within the protective mantle of the First Amendment. Artistic integrity can mean, the skeptical judge continued, an actor's desire to perform a role as she wishes, the right of an artist to write, paint, or compose free of any outside restraints, or a myriad of other activities involving artistic creation and expression. Or, in a more recent argument, swear words in a television broadcast regulated by the Federal Communications Commission. Visual artists have explicit artistic integrity protection in a federal statute. The law gives the author of a work of visual art the right to prevent any intentional distortion, mutilation, or other modification of that work which would be prejudicial to his or her honor or reputation. One can absolutely imagine Pink Floyd making the argument that selling parts of an overall musical work as standalone pieces distorts, mutilates, and modifies enough to prejudice musical honor. I'd certainly buy that. The argument, and the album, which I'd then listen to without shuffling. One final point for those who would dare shuffle through Elton John, Pink Floyd, or Pink, and you know who you are, would one ever in a million years shuffle one's way through the movements of a symphony? I didn't think so. I'm Amy Guida.
Earth and Sky.
It's pretty surprising that in this day and age, we know so little about such big things under the sea. You would think we'd know everything we need to know about this planet.
You're listening to marine biologist Joe Pollack at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He studies giant barrel sponges growing on coral reefs in the Caribbean. Pollack refers to these sponges as the redwoods of the deep because they resemble trees in their enormous size.
They do remind you somewhat of trees. They're massive. You can fit a diver inside the cavity that's in the center of particularly large individuals.